From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the cable channels and TV networks are touting their fall shows. What is going to happen without Game of Thrones? Then documentary filmmaker Avi Belkin discovers another side to Mike Wallace, the iconic, unflinching TV interviewer.
Every day, Mike would wake up in the morning feeling he has to prove to the world that he's a serious journalist. And I'm talking about even after he was the number one journalist in the world, he would still feel that way.
And we'll visit the headquarters of some do-it-yourself video game designers. All that coming up on The Frame.
This is Larry Mantle. Join me for our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights, 1970s LA's porn industry in transition. Saturday night, July 27th at the Theater at Ace Hotel. Tickets at kpcc.org/in-person.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. A couple of times a year, dozens of the nation's top TV reporters and reviewers gather at the TCAs. It's an acronym for the Television Critics Association, and it's where TV networks and cable channels introduce new shows and give the media a snapshot of their business. Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. He's also the president of the TCA. I reached him in Beverly Hills between panels today, and I began by asking him how much the streaming services are affecting the talks at the current TCAs.
I think that they're in the background. I think that everyone acknowledges that that is a major conversation piece, and I think we're going to be talking about all of those new streaming services this week, but none of those services have decided to present at this tour, basically, because they're all kind of nascent and they're all on the verge of existing. So I'm assuming that probably come winter tour in January, we might see a couple of those players show up and actually present their wares. Instead, they're really the elephant in the corner of the room that people can't ignore but also can't fully discuss.
So one of the first presentations is from HBO. They're losing Game of Thrones. They're making a lot more original content. What are you looking for from HBO?
Oh, I think the HBO panels this afternoon are going to be fascinating, whether it's HBO Max, et cetera, which will have to be discussed because it's a question of whether the brand is being diluted by giving the HBO name over to something that also includes repeats of Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Then there's also, were people truly disappointed by the last season of Game of Thrones, or was it just a loud minority on Twitter? Are they ready to say yet whether they're moving forward on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, any of the Game of Thrones prequels, et cetera? Then there was Andrea Arnold, the director of Big Little Lies, and whether she was squeezed out in the editing room. So there are many topics of conversation, and they're coming on top of the fact that last week at the Emmy nominations, HBO utterly dominated. So on one hand, you have the possibility that things could get acrimonious, and then you have the possibility that Casey Bloys could just stand up there going, yeah, better than ever before. Come at me.
So one of the channels that hasn't gotten a lot of attention as part of the Fox-Disney merger is National Geographic. That is now under the Disney umbrella, and they're now going to try to find Amelia Earhart's plane. Is that right?
Yes, that was one of the things that they announced yesterday, that the scientist who found the Titanic, basically, Dr. Bob Ballard, is leading a charge to find Earhart's plane, and also hopefully her remains, apparently, and that it's a largely female-driven expedition crew, and it can be currently seen in progress online streaming, and then basically what they hope that when they find the plane, it will be a big blowout for Nat Geo, and I think it would be, because heaven knows I am old enough, sadly, to remember what a huge deal it was when they found the Titanic. And it would be interesting if the world could all come together for another moment of discovery like that.
Yeah, one problem, Amelia Earhart's plane is a little bit smaller than the Titanic. And another series that I think nobody really knows when it's going to come back, and that is FX's Atlanta. Donald Glover, also known as Childish Gambino, has been really busy. Any news on when or if Atlanta's going to return?
I think we will ask John Landgraf during the FX panels, and his answer will be, frankly, what it's always been, which is when Donald Glover is ready, we'll have another season of Atlanta. Maybe he'll say, here are the things he has on his plate before then, but I'm not even sure that anyone knows. That always used to be FX's policy on Louis, is, you know, when Louis has the material for another season of Louis, there will be another season of Louis. And I think that basically Donald Glover has the Louis C.K. deal. But yeah, it's going to be one of those when he's ready, it'll happen, in the same way that we will definitely be able to talk about details about the upcoming season of Fargo, which is now fully cast up and will begin production later this year, apparently in Chicago. With FX, they don't keep to a schedule in the same way that a lot of other people do. They have a lot of talent who they attempt to nurture, and part of nurturing talent means letting talent do what they want to do to some degree.
There's four big award shows, the Oscars, the Grammys, the Tonys, and the upcoming Emmys. The TCA Awards maybe are trying to get in as number five. What are the TCA Awards, and why are they important to you and your organization?
Oh, well, basically what I always hope is that we give awards to a bunch of great shows and that people go, okay, maybe I haven't heard of Russian Doll. Maybe I haven't heard of Rami, which unfortunately wasn't nominated but should have been. Here's what the critics really love. I hope that we would love it too. We just want people to think that the awards that we give out are given out honorably and that it means something to win it. So I don't know if that's necessarily the same as joining EGOT as TGOT. Heaven knows I would love to see something like that. Last year we gave Rita Moreno our Lifetime Achievement Award, so she is a TGOT winner, but I'd love to see it. Don't currently think it's happening, but it's always a good show.
And finally, you are a TV critic and you also get very excited about certain shows. Have there been a snippet or a trailer or even an episode of an upcoming series that you have seen as part of TCA that you are already really excited about?
I cannot give you specific details, but I can say that every additional thing that I have seen from HBO's Watchmen makes me more and more curious to see more from it. And it could be one of those shows that the more you see, the more it becomes demystified. And once you actually see what the show is, it becomes that wasn't what I wanted it to be. It wasn't what I needed it to be. But at this moment, nothing that HBO has done for that show has done anything other than make me more and more excited. I look forward to being disappointed heartily by it.
Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter. He is also the president of the Television Critics Association, and he joined us from the TCA meetings in Beverly Hills. Daniel, thanks for taking time out.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up on The Frame, a documentary about 60 Minutes veteran Mike Wallace, who harbored a lot of doubts about his self-worth. Now a new documentary about a man who transformed the usually friendly TV interview into something a lot tougher and much more newsworthy. Mike Wallace is best known as the unflinching TV reporter who co-hosted 60 Minutes on CBS. Before he died in 2012, after more than 50 years in broadcast journalism, Wallace had interviewed almost every important figure of his day. Now, Avi Belkin has made the documentary Mike Wallace Is Here. It's told without talking heads, just older interviews, and never-before-seen archival footage of Wallace and his colleagues. I asked Belkin why he made his documentary that way.
There's a beautiful moment in the film, which is my favorite exchange, between Mike and Oriana Fallaci.
She plays the role of judge. The interviewee is on trial. And few are found innocent.
She is a journalist from the 70s in Europe. She was basically a female version of Mike Wallace with bad teeth. And she was a very tough, again, investigative journalist in Europe. And they have a conversation between them.
You are not one of those who think that we journalists have power.
No?
We are like the dogs. Wow, wow, wow. And nobody listens to us.
You're an entertainer?
And Mike asks her, are you an entertainer? And not only does that question, is basically a question that Mike was asked his entire career. It just shows beautifully how Mike kind of took the questions that were presented to him and presented them to others. But also, it kind of sets the tone for what the interview is going to be like. And she answers, no, I'm an historian. And Mike is like, you're not an historian, you're a journalist. And then she says,
yes, I am.
You're a journalist.
No, sir. A journalist is an historian.
No, wait.
Listen, a journalist is a person who writes history in the same moment that history happens. and it is the damn best way to write history.
And I kind of feel the same way about the film. In a way, I could have done a story where I, you know, interview people today and they would be like, oh yeah, Mike changed the game. Mike, in that period of time, was da-da-da. Being a historian, 20, 50 years after the event, analyzing it with, you know, the scope of what happened since. But I chose to do a film that's the Oriana Fallaci mythology, which basically gave us the times of the film. So when you focus only on archives, you don't have anyone processing the events in retrospect. You're just living it at the times. And I felt like it's a much more honest representation of what journalism is. So that was kind of what informed me on that. And the second element was that we got access to this treasure trove of materials. That was the first time that CBS opened up their archives. So I was just very lucky on that aspect that I had all those interviews that we usually see on television, which are like 8 minutes, 10 minutes. I got hours of them, the raw footage.
Mike Wallace is known to almost everybody for 60 Minutes, but he had a big career before that, and his career wasn't always in journalism. He did some radio, he did a lot of acting, a lot of commercial work, and then he has this show, Nightbeat, and it happens at a time when interviewing is really kind of puffy. It's very soft questions, it's couch stuff, it's like Merv Griffin.
What you're about to witness is strictly personal, a direct, undiluted, unrehearsed, uncensored interview. My role is that of a reporter. I think that you will agree that you have a rather remarkable record for being called names.
That's right.
President Roosevelt once called you a chronic liar. The late Tennessee Senator Kenneth McKellar called you an ignorant liar, a pusillanimous liar, a peewee liar, a liar in the daytime and a liar in the nighttime, end quote. What is there about Drew Pearson that inspires such bitterness?
Well, Mike, I can't give an objective answer on that.
Could it be that you're a liar?
So what is happening in this series that really sets up what Mike Wallace and his colleagues are going to do on 60 Minutes?
Well, first of all, the introduction, right? Before he even starts the thing, just setting up the thing like a stage, right? And I think that's what Mike changed with journalism in a way. Mike came, like you said, from the show business side of things. He was a pitchman. He was a game show host. He really knew how to perform. And that show, Nightbeat, really not only changed the interview landscape, but basically gave birth to Mike Wallace, the character that we know today. And that was the first time that the questions were abrasive. They were very confrontational, but also very well dramatic, but you know what I mean? Like, they chose to be dramatic. There was the cigarette smoke, the backlighting. It looked almost like a police investigation scene.
There is so much cigarette smoking in this documentary. It's really startling. Not just the men, the women, everybody's smoking all the time in the interviews on camera. Yeah. It's kind of remarkable, and it feels like such an artifact. I'm going to play another clip, and this is kind of at a pivotal moment, not only in the history of American journalism, but in the history of 60 Minutes, and it's around Watergate. And this is probably one of Mike Wallace's most famous interviews, I would say, with John Ehrlichman, who was counsel and assistant to the president for domestic affairs under Richard Nixon.
Did you see Senator Weicker enumerate a list of the illegal or unethical acts of the White House?
No, I didn't.
Let me read them. Breaking and entering. Wiretapping. Conspiracy to foster prostitution. Conspiracy to commit kidnapping. Destruction of government documents. Forgery of State Department documents and campaign letters. Secret slush funds. Perjury. Plans to audit tax returns for political retaliation. Theft of psychiatric records. Plans to firebomb a building. All of this by the Law and Order Administration of Richard Nixon.
Is there a question in there somewhere?
And what you're missing is John Ehrlichman is just in a flop sweat. Yeah. He just looks as uncomfortable as anybody could possibly be.
This is such an iconic moment, I feel like. This is like the Jordan switching hand basket, you know, if we were in sport. This is a moment where Mike was most proud of. He always said this was his best question ever. And the beautiful thing about it, it's not even a question. And then at the end, it just lets it sit and just goes to show you sometimes just raising the question, even if you're not getting an answer, is enough in journalism to kind of put the debate on the table and to put the confrontation.
We're talking with Avi Belkin, the director of Mike Wallace's here. there are a couple moments toward the end of the documentary where the story is less about Mike Wallace and it's more about litigation and threats of litigation and how that affects not only 60 Minutes, but also other news outlets. There's two cases that are central. One is a libel suit brought by General William Westmoreland against 60 Minutes. And then there's a threatened litigation by a tobacco company to block Jeffrey Wigand, a whistleblower, from appearing on 60 Minutes and talking about tobacco.
Today it was revealed that CBS's 60 Minutes had decided to back off a tough investigative report on the powerful tobacco industry.
Raising new questions tonight about corporate power and what's acceptable in journalism, what's not.
What do those two episodes say about what's happening in media at this time and how companies are threatened by litigation and basically become really timid about what it is they're going to report?
The 70s journalism hit its peak, its prime, with, you know, Watergate, the Vietnam coverage that really a lot of people believe changed the war. So a lot of people in power, whether it be politicians or companies, felt that journalism was becoming to be a bigger problem, and they started pushing back. And one of the tools that they're doing it is the libel suit. So there is a kind of a, it happens between the year 82 to 95, and you actually see in that decade the change and how today we obviously know that most news outlets are owned by corporations. And a lot of the time, the interests of those corporations do not align with the news angle of things. And those two stories are kind of the genesis stories of what we see today in the, you know, interference with journalists. There's something beautiful that Mike says in Nightbeat, actually in 56, where he says, "A nation's press is a good yardstick of a nation's health." And I think today there's definitely a feeling that the press is in a very precarious tipping point, I would say, where a lot of people are not really sure are they getting the real story, because there's so many outlets today. And Donald Trump is obviously, you know, hitting those points as well. Like, who do you trust? In a way, who's a journalist today? There's so many people giving you the news today that are not even journalists. And I'm kind of always curious about talking with journalists. You're a journalist, obviously. How do you see it from your perspective?
Well, I think what's most interesting is Mike Wallace's son, Chris Wallace, works at Fox News.
That's crazy.
And Mike Wallace certainly had his detractors, but I think you would never question his objectivity. Fox News, you would question everything it says because it has a partisan agenda. I think CBS News did not. And I think that's the fundamental difference, and you see it in a generation.
It's beautiful.
Let me ask you this last question. It's fair to say you're younger than I am, so yeah, you probably didn't grow up watching as much Mike Wallace as I did. In the making of the film, how are your assumptions about who he was and what he did challenged and changed by your research and by the things that you start to see and hear and read about him?
Well, I think, again, that's the most rewarding element of his story for me. You start this movie, and I started, obviously, the research on Mike, thinking here is this John Wayne character, a tough guy, you know, an unflinching interviewer that is, in a way, one-dimensional. He's tough, you know? And then when you start peeling out the layers, you find this insecure man in a level that you can't really understand. He was... Every day, Mike would wake up in the morning feeling he has to prove to the world that he's a serious journalist. And I'm talking about even after he was the number one journalist in the world, he would still feel that way. So just discovering that for me is an amazing thing, because you immediately connect to a person who's like everybody else.
Avi Belkin is the director of Mike Wallace's Here. It opens on Friday, July 26th.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next on The Frame, not all popular video games are made by big-budget companies. We'll visit a do-it-yourself collective for independent game designers. Video games are a multi-billion dollar industry, raking in more than Hollywood, the music industry, and streaming services. But it's not all blockbusters like Red Dead Redemption 2 and Call of Duty. Some indie do-it-yourself developers are quietly making some memorably quirky games in the shadow of the major studios. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving visited a collective of game designers in Culver City. We now revisit his report.
This is a video game called Dream Daddy. It's a dad dating simulator. Not exactly a conventional commercial video game, but that's the spirit at Glitch City, a collective of indie game artists and developers co-founded by Ben Esposito.
No one's making money from this. Like, this is just people trying to help other people make interesting art. And so I think if you're cool with the DIY, if you're cool with the empty weird warehouse, then you belong here.
It is a pretty empty warehouse, a small industrial space off Robertson Boulevard in Culver City that kind of feels like garage meets dorm room, complete with a string of Christmas lights draped overhead. Esposito started Glitch City in 2013 along with another Ben Vance.
At times we've described ourselves as kind of an art collective, a game collective, something in between, and we're not just trying to clone other games or like make games at any cost. You know, we're all trying to challenge it, the medium, in a different way, or to kind of take a different approach. And there is a DIY, kind of a little bit of a punk aesthetic.
Another founding member was Eric, who preferred not to give his last name.
I was just working at coffee shops a lot, and that was like my main way of like staying sane and keeping on task. But, you know, you don't have to work at a coffee shop alone. So it really just took me asking both the Bens to basically, let's just work at a coffee shop. And eventually that got called Strawberry Jam, which became kind of a precursor to Glitch City.
Today, Glitch City has a fluid group of about 24 citizens. But this isn't a video game company. Everyone here is making their own games, and many of them make their living as contract artists for other clients, like Rachel Sala.
People are like, hey, I need a logo, or I need some animation, or I need someone to skin this mini game for me. That's how I get most of my work.
Sala made the coffee today.
Make it basically every day. It's not good. You can drink it, though. It does the job.
Part of the benefit of Glitch City is that like doing your own project is very hard.
Brendan Chung used to work for a major game studio. Now he runs his own indie company out of Glitch City.
I have holes in my knowledge, and I could like look to my right and say, hey, take a look at this. What would you think about this? Everyone just kind of like understands where every project is, and we all can kind of like chip in and kind of give feedback on how everyone else is doing. There's something kind of magical there.
People aren't just developing games here. Candy Emberly is a composer.
So yeah, I'm writing music for a battle right now. We have all these different kinds of monsters, and you can have what's essentially a boss fight with any of them, and the hope is that it will all be recorded live at the end. That's a funding question.
Rather than corporate meetings, Glitch City does family dinners, as Eric explains.
It's a meeting, but more informal than a group meeting. Because if it was a true meeting, it'd just be chaos having, you know, like 20 people try to do some input towards that.
Eric's also being modest.
Here's Ben Vance again.
Because there's usually a giant dinner that's prepared, and it's often him or Rachel that are taking care of that. So there's a bunch of food and a bunch of sharing of what's going on in the space.
The games coming out of Glitch City are as diverse and quirky as its residents. Ben Esposito made a game called Donut County.
It's a game where you play as a hole in the ground, and you start really small, and you move it under stuff to make it fall in, and every time you eat something, it gets a little bit bigger. And so it's a game about kind of like scale and destruction and like what happens to a place over time as you like start to erase the things from it.
Eric's currently working on a game called Oft Horizon,
which is a seafaring exploration game. I've been working on it for many, many years, but not continuously and not full time. But it's about exploring a world that changes over time.
Last year, Brendan Chung released Quadrilateral Cowboy.
It's a far cry from the days of file cabinets and phone books.
You play as one of three ladies who are starting a startup company where companies hire you to hack other companies. So you're like guns for hire, basically. But instead of guns, you have computers. And it's set in this alternate 1980s universe, and everything's very clunky, everything's very analog.
Ben Vance is in the midst of developing a virtual reality experience called Irrational Exuberance,
which is a deep space exploration. It's kind of like an experiment in ripping you out of, you know, your current reality and just throwing you out into deep space as yourself, and trying to make that sort of tangible.
And the first game Rachel Sala ever put out was called Frog Fractions.
Which is a comedy game, has nothing to do with math, you won't learn anything if you play it, and it's about the joy of discovery and the spirit of exploration. So you do literally play as a frog, but you go into space, become president of Bug Mars, and silly things happen overall.
These are clearly all slightly idiosyncratic labors of love. I asked Rachel Sala, is this an exciting time to be an indie game developer? Or a scary one?
It's scary because there's a lot riding on it. there's always pressure to perform well and do well. And I think a lot of us here at this point are pretty far along in our careers, and we want to keep making successful games. And there's a lot of creativity out there. There's a lot of wild ideas. Almost every day there's some game that comes out. I'm like, oh, I wish I thought of that.
But Ben Vance says being a citizen of Glitch City means you don't have to truck it alone.
It's really hard making creative work. Especially in a vacuum when you don't have anything to bounce your ideas off of. You know, staying motivated is one of the biggest things, and having a space for that and people to, you know, connect with, talk to, and just even just like commiserate with, you know. What problems are you dealing with? Oh, yeah, that one.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that's the show for today. You could look for us on Twitter and Facebook, and you'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow.